It's Tuesday, April 23rd, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. So let's say you like two things in life, pot and puns. You want them both because, you know, stoners like wordplay. Well, I refer you to this story on WBNG News 12, Binghamton, New York.
A lit day today in Broome County. Holly Street and Collier Street shut down in honor of the holidays. Saturday sparked the fourth annual smoke weed outside of the Binghamton Police Department celebration. Folks rolled up to the joint looking to get high and partake in the occasion. It started promptly at 4:20, featuring live music, snacks, and even some free Narcan training sessions and guest speakers.
I THC what you did there. Then the local Binghamton station cuts to a stoner who seems less into bone mows and more into bongs.
For us, I think it means celebrating that it's finally legalized and that we are able to actually walk down the street and smoke a joint, even in front of the police station.
Fair enough, Sparky. But you hear that siren in the background? You would think it didn't have to travel far because the smoke pot outside the Binghamton police station event takes place right outside the Binghamton police station. And this coverage the next day on WBNG, WBong Binghamton, confirms that not all those pot smokers outside the Binghamton police station stayed outside the Binghamton police station.
Wasn't all love and peace and happiness a Saturday smoke weed outside of Binghamton police station. According to the Broome County Sheriff, 14 people are facing various charges, including making graffiti, stealing a law enforcement body camera, disorderly conduct, resisting arrest, and obstruction of justice.
The police are right there. You're gonna get caught, you goofy stoners. I mean, they could have defunded 90% of the police and they still would have made those particular arrests. It's harder not to. What part of outside the Binghamton police station don't you get? Oh yeah, all of it, because you were bombed out of your head on ganja, you freak. Also, maybe you want to consider that the delight that you take in smoking pot outside the Binghamton police station might not be shared by all those inside the Binghamton police station, to wit, the Binghamton police. And they have the footage of all the crimes you committed, or would have if you hadn't stolen the camera. Anyway, it's all pretty low level. Those arrested have been given desk tickets and won't get jail time. Well, that depends, I guess, on their participation in the fourth annual skip out of your arraignment hearing outside Binghamton Municipal Court. The local news says bailing out on that would be an indictment of your judgment. On the show today, it is a full show interview, and I'll tell you why. It's because when you first start listening to Ray Suarez talk about anything, but especially about his new book on immigration, We Are Home, Becoming American in the 21st Century in Oral History, you won't want to stop listening, so I shan't make you stop. Ray Suarez is the former anchor of the PBS NewsHour, former host of Talk of the Nation on NPR, and author of We Are Home, Becoming American in the 21st Century in Oral History, which is out today. We'll discuss the whack, to quote Ray, his word, the whack way we remember the story of immigration in American history, the conundrum of open borders, and all the incredible stories of what people do to be Americans. Ray Suarez up next. So you've heard me say, perhaps in an ad in the recent past, that first we make our habits, then they make us. That is a quote attributed to the English poet John Dryden. I believe he was the first poet laureate. It is poetic. First we make our habits, then they make us. Let's talk about the inverse of that. What do we do when we want to get rid of a habit? What about when we think our habits are, let us say, unmaking us? Enter a product I'm here to talk to you about. It's called Fume. Fume is not a vapor, it's flavored air. So what it does is it takes one habit that maybe you're trying to kick and replace it with a behavior that has the look and feel of that habit, but not the detriments. It's pleasant, it's similar. It's replacing a bad habit with a different, more positive behavior. And now with all orders, you could buy one, get one on their cores, which are their different flavorings. You could stock up throughout the year, these cold winter months, something to do, something to exhale, flavored air. So nice. And as a listener of The Gist, you'll get an extra 10% off when you use the code. Head to tryfume.com/thegist and use the code THEGIST for an additional 10% off plus BOGO cores to help start making the good habit that much easier. Thank you, Shaka Smart. We are joined by an opulent and respected stranger, though he is not a stranger to these shores or to your ears. Ray Suarez was, of course, the longtime host of Talk of the Nation. That's first in my heart, and then PBS NewsHour, where you probably saw him. And he's also hosted The Gist. He's out now with a new book. It is a combination of policy analysis, history, and oral history. It is called We Are Home, Becoming American in the 21st Century, an Oral History. Ray Suarez, welcome back to The Gist.
Great to talk to you, Mike. How you been?
I've been well. This isn't an oral history in the normal sense, where it is just a bunch of people speaking and then a colon and then we hear their testimony. It's mostly a written through oral history with a lot of first person analysis, but also a lot of your analysis. Why did you want to structure it that way?
Well, I thought it was really important to put immigrants themselves front and center and their stories, but also weave their stories into the wider story of immigration to the United States, because I found that the American discourse about immigration is so, oh man, it's just so ill-informed, so pseudo-historical, so whack that we really needed a sort of antidote. And I wanted to hear a lot from immigrants, but I also wanted to couch it very heavily in the longer and broader American experience. So I sort of squared that circle by doing it that way.
Yeah, and that phrase that I threw out in the beginning of the opulent and respected stranger, that comes from the writings or the mouth of George Washington, who is talking about America is not just welcoming to princes or princelings, but to everyone. So that was an ideal. And I guess it was easier for that to be an ideal when the country was nascent and it was just a vast expanse of wilderness and we kind of needed all the people we could get.
Yes, there was an idea that the people of Western Europe would make their way over here. You needed to keep front and center the illusion that there was nobody here, which was really central to the American self-concept in that age, that it was a big, open, empty territory, and we were going to people it. It was a new Jerusalem, and a new promised chosen people were going to come and people it and keep pushing the people who were already there west. It was only when the complexities of millions of people making their way here started to really bite later in the 19th century that we started to think more about what it meant to have so many different people from so many different places come and make a home here. And that's where the fun begins.
And so when did the United States, I know there was the Chinese Exclusion Act, but when did it become harder to emigrate to America than not?
Apart from the Chinese Exclusion Act, it was really easy. Whenever an American says, well, yes, my family's from fill in the blank, but when my ancestors came, they followed the rules. It's very easy to say because for most, well, all of the 19th century, and the beginning of the 20th century, there were hardly any rules. So it was easy for your great-great-grandpa and your great-great-grandma in their kerchief and sort of interesting ethnic hats to get here and take a ferry that landed them on a railway head or in Lower Manhattan and get their American journey started. Except if you were, as you mentioned, Chinese, the Chinese Exclusion Act, the only national legislation that specifically excluded one race of immigrants from coming to the United States, which was on the books for 75 years or so, was the shameful exception. But it was, if you were coming from Europe, it was pretty darn easy to come until 1924.
And that was the Johnson Reed Act. And that was, well, I know how it was interpreted by the courts, and I know from your writing the arguments made for it, but it was, as I understand it, a pretty explicitly white supremacist or white exclusionary act, and that was the motivation. They didn't shy away from that being the motivation.
Not only white, but favoring Western Europe to the exclusion of Southern and Eastern Europe.
Maybe that's how they would have defined white at the time.
Right, right. Yeah. There was a feeling that too many people with foreign ideas and foreign ideologies and foreign religions and foreign customs had come into the United States all at once. And to be sure, between 1875 and 1920, boy, a lot of people had come from a lot of places, speaking a lot of languages and talking to God in a lot of different ways. And whether you were worried about anarchists or trade unionists or communists or socialists, you figured the best way to shut that tap off was to stop high, unregulated levels of immigration. And the 1924 Immigration and Nationality Act helps get you there.
So then Lyndon Baines Johnson signs into law the 1965 Act, and that is a law of intended and unintended consequences. And you at one point puzzle out, I wonder how much Johnson knew about how transformative the law would be. There are echoes of his famous statement about, we've lost the South for a generation. No, we've lost it for several generations after the Civil Rights Act. But it's a similar bill that he signed because he's so smart and savvy. He must have known that it would have been deeply transformative, even in ways that he assured the American public it wouldn't be.
Certainly, there were indications at that early stage in 1965 that there was interest in coming to this country. I think we were at such a low ebb. It's hard to remember that in 1960, the proportion of foreign-born Americans was about a third of what it is today. And immigrants trended older than the rest of the population because there had been such a sustained pause in immigration in the Depression and World War II that an immigrant was more likely to be your grandma than one of your kids' classmates. We had also had a baby boom. So the math coming out of the 1950s was such that immigration was a nostalgic question. There, in the earliest generation of television, you saw sitcoms or family dramas like The Goldbergs and I Remember Mama, where the immigrants were the older members of the family. They had interesting accents, and they sometimes did malapropisms in English and said, oh, right. Grandma, the old country they would talk about.
Chico Marx and the closets where you open them up and all the items would fall
exactly.
out. That was a classic Goldberg's sound effects conceit.
So what they weren't worried about was a flood of 22-year-olds. And both Lyndon Johnson, as you mentioned, and Teddy Kennedy, who was one of the legislation's big champions in the Senate, got people over the line by assuring them that not that much was going to change. And in fact, the hunger for the United States was great, and the family reunification provisions inside the new law brought people through chain migration, which is a very controversial aspect of immigration law now. And yeah, it's changed America. The demographic revolution that's underway now, where people of European ancestry will be a slight minority of Americans after mid-century, that really begins with the 1965 law.
What were the politics of chain migration or family unification at the time? How did that factor into the various constituencies debating the bill?
Well, early proponents and opponents of the bill were very interested in family unification, especially in like Great Lakes and Northeastern districts that were, for the time, very heavily both World War II refugee, Cold War refugee, and immigrant heavy. they wanted to make sure that people could still bring over their uncle and their cousin.
And those immigrant, when we say immigrant heavy, they were Slavic, they were Polish, they were,
and Italian and so on. They wanted to make sure relatives of people who were already here could continue to come. What they weren't so sure about was whether they wanted people from places that hadn't been big sources of migration in the past, like South Asia, to come in large numbers. It's hard to remember now, with not only members of Congress, but the Surgeon General of the United States and major American personalities being Indian and Pakistani and Bangladeshi, it's hard to remember how few South Asians there were in the United States when the act was passed in 1965, how relatively few Chinese there were, because right after the Chinese Exclusion Act was sort of ditched during World War II, during that brief window when China was an ally in World War II, trying to expel the Japanese from the Chinese mainland, the People's Liberation Army completed the takeover of mainland China, the People's Republic is proclaimed, and immigration from the Chinese mainland slows to a trickle. So Chinese population was very small in 1965. And also, we have to remember the Cold War and how the Cold War changed some of the rationale around this stuff. Even people who didn't necessarily think the rest of the world was going to clamor into the United States did think it looked bad that the United States had what acted as racially exclusive immigration laws up until 1965. It looked bad to the rest of the world. Kennedy and later Johnson were both very conscious of that, as were the bill's sponsors.
So it's interesting because your book then gets us into, it does bring us up into the present and we get into DACA. But along the way, there's the Bush administration CBO extensive report on immigration. And there are three main things they said they wanted immigration to do. And they were consistent. These were consistent from the bill you're talking about with LBJ. One was to unify families. Two was refugee for people who are being persecuted. And three was to foster immigrants who might be of use or had special skills for the United States. I guess that concept, the third one, wasn't as in play 40 years later. But this is basically, and I don't know how conscious it was, this is how America has always defined and prioritized the purposes of immigration. And my question to you is, has that been a misprioritization? What would things have been differently if they, you know, said we're going to put skills first and family unification third?
You know, during the 19th century, there was no explicit requirement of such, but the country prospered mightily because when you take in a mix of people, you get craftsmen and mechanics and teachers and poets and musicians and farmers, and you get an accidental or incidental cross-section of humanity. Well, the CBO report makes explicit, I think, some of the coalition building around immigration, that those ideas have to be spelled out in order to get the various people you want on board moving forward. Yes, family reunification. Yes, refugees. You're in effect speaking to 50 or 60 different members of the House at a time when you roll out those different priorities. And you hear it in the debates where some members of Congress, some members of the Senate will say, I'm not sure that this is necessarily what the country needs. And so you say, aha, that's someone who really needs to hear more about, you know, trained people and college-educated people coming here. And when you hear somebody lamenting the fact that a constituent can't get their mother here, you think, make a mental note. We're going to make sure that that guy is able to get this constituent threaded through immigration and naturalization. The same sort of sausage making that people lament in all kinds of policy is it's like when a teacher in math class says, show your work. That's what the CBO report does. Right. You're in effect saying, okay, here's what we want, and here's what we're going to tell you we need, and you'll tell us you're okay with it.
So there are so many slogans and truths and truisms relating to immigration, and what your book does in pushing forward actual immigrants, and we get to understand their experiences. Sometimes it exemplifies some of these truths and truisms. Sometimes it explodes them. Give me a couple examples that were really eye-opening for you, or you think would be eye-opening for the reader and now our listener.
Well, there's such, I on purpose. I mean, you're a smart guy. You read the book and you knew that these people didn't make it by accident. I just didn't say, okay, let me talk to the first 100 people I meet and I'll just tell their story, period. I wanted them to, through their life story, exemplify various aspects of what's happened in the country over the past 50 years. So a Nelson Castillo, his mother goes north, overstays a tourist visa and becomes a maid to a powerful and influential public official in the Northeast, who I do not name at his request. That person helps her get legal, but says, look, if you're going to bring your kid, you can't be my maid anymore. And Nelson, who's Salvadoran, his mother goes back down to Salvador once she gets legal. She cannot leave the country until she gets legal to go get him. Mm-hmm. And then once she's legal, she goes and gets him, brings him, and he didn't want to go, brings him reluctantly as a non-English speaking Salvadoran kid to Long Island. And he's now an immigration attorney. Samir, a wonderful sort of accidental Forrest Gumpy kind of life, who it was born in Mombasa, of the very old Arabic community in that Indian Ocean city in Kenya, comes to Columbia, Maryland, a planned community in the suburbs around Baltimore and Washington, is restless, is unhappy, joins the military after just a couple of months in the country, and gets shipped out to Korea. And Koreans, practicing their English, would ask him what he thinks of America. And he'd basically honestly say, I don't know. I haven't lived in America. And there he is in a United States Army uniform. A remarkable story of sort of finding your footing, understanding what it means to play the game, and using the rules in a way that both benefits the country and benefits his family tremendously. I think people are going to fall in love with Samir.
Yeah.
People who snuck into the country, came under false premises, people who lied to get into the country. People yeah. have all kinds of stories. I hope that along the course of the book, you will both grit your teeth, breathe hard and exasperatedly as you see some of these stories, and also have your heart warmed by the things that people do to get over. It's a mix. It's meant to be a mix.
And we'll be back with more of Ray Suarez. Remember, I promise you the conundrum in the lead up. That comes first in the second half of our interview. We're back with Ray Suarez, author of the book We Are Home, Becoming American in the 21st Century in Oral History. And I told Ray of my conundrum, and it's this. Almost every immigrant that I've met, that I've talked to, has a story somewhere on the continuum of impressive to truly inspiring. I'm talking about legal immigrants, undocumented immigrants. Your heart goes out to all of them, almost all of them, every single one, and you want them to succeed on an individual level. But on a national level, open borders, they're not sustainable. So how do you square that? That every individual story is so inspiring, but the agglomeration of all those individual stories just can't be allowed to exist. You need to regulate this process. And I think the government has to find a way to sadly say, yeah, even these really inspiring stories in many cases can't be allowed to happen. What do you do?
There has to be a sorting mechanism. Every country in the world needs to be able to be aware of who's coming in, who's staying, who's going home. and the terms under which, the rules that you're going to set out for this system to be effectuated. We have lost control of the plot, in part because the gears of our national legislature have seized up, and we no longer have an effective Congress when it comes to setting those rules, negotiating places where there are differences of opinion, and coming up with solutions where nobody gets everything they want, but most of the negotiators get much of what they want. We've lost the talent. We no longer can do it. And it shows in our immigration law. If you are someone who's upset by what you're seeing at the border, vote for bills that increase the number of immigration judges, that increase the number of border agents, that increase the number of hearing rooms, that increase the capacity. Because right now, the world is on the move. The fantasy is that the United States was somehow going to blithely float above the crisis that's going on in the rest of the world, where people are pouring across borders in Africa, in Asia, in parts of Central Europe. This idea that people would pour out of Syria as civilian populations are being bombed by their own government and head to Turkey and Greece and Italy, that people would pour out of North Africa in critical countries that are falling to pieces and only go to Italy and only go to France and only go to Britain, that Cuba could have a continuing economic meltdown, and Venezuela could be a failed state, and this would never have anything to do with us, was a fantasy. The world is in crisis. The world is on the move. We needed a smart, strategic, and responsive answer to this. And we didn't come up with one. So now we're in the midst of ad hocery. That's what we're plagued with now. Responding to the crisis today, just for today, and hoping that tomorrow takes care of itself.
So knowing what you know and feeling how you feel, how do you regard the cynical, but I would say effective tactics of Greg Abbott and other Southern governors who have shipped their migrants north so that they would say the pain of it, they would say the reality of the immigration problem is felt by people in Denver, Chicago, and New York who maybe previously just regarded opposition or consternation about immigration as mostly a extension of racism. What do you think of what they've done?
It's really the absolute epitome of stunt policymaking, because Greg Abbott, if he doesn't know, he should know, but I think he does know, that New York is already home to 650,000 undocumented people. That's like having the entire city of Milwaukee inside your corporate limits. The idea that New York hasn't been facing the undocumented crisis is ridiculous on its face. The idea that Los Angeles and Chicago and Denver have not been already facing this problem is stupid. And because he doesn't have a land border, Ron DeSantis going and borrowing undocumented people from Texas so he could get in on the action was also stunt policymaking. And sending them to Martha's Vineyard out of some idea that, you know, here we're going to show, ha ha, those liberals, they won't know what hit them. Well, Martha's Vineyard did what a beach town would do. It got the people to places where there was social service infrastructure to handle the people who were arriving by plane on the small airstrip on that tiny offshore island of Massachusetts. Massachusetts first, the churches sprang into action so that these Venezuelans, they weren't wandering the streets of these little charming towns in Martha's Vineyard. They were sleeping in church basements and gymnasiums and being given food by the year-round population of this place. I don't know what Ron DeSantis thought he was trying to do, but whatever he thought he was going to do, it failed because those people had caseworkers and social workers and were on their way to being handled within days of their arrival in Martha's Vineyard. It was just silly. And it doesn't get us one inch closer to a real answer to what's going on.
I don't think I agree with you totally on the Martha's Vineyard and the DeSantis point. But on the Abbott point, I would again say it's cynical, but it is savvy. And we can't have a before and after judgment of most of the cities that he shipped the asylum seekers to because they have new mayors. But I have to believe that if there weren't these new immigrants being shipped to them, Eric Adams in New York and Brandon Johnson, the mayor of Chicago, would at least rhetorically be discussing the problem differently. But when the problem is now at their doorstep and they have to deal with constituencies who clearly aren't racist, but say there are only limited resources to go around, and I think you should give them to us, your voters and the people who live in this community, rather than asylum seekers, it is a conundrum. And when the conundrum is abstract, a mayor can talk about it one way. When the problem is at his doorstep, he has to talk about it, or she has to talk about it a different way.
If you are from a political party that is refusing to appropriate further emergency help to ease the problem at the border where it first arrives, you are helping to elevate the crisis and make it more of a crisis. Alejandro Mayorkas did not make Venezuela a failed state. Joe Biden didn't make Cuba an economic basket case. The current head of border enforcement did not make El Salvador a dangerous place to be a teenager. These are problems of the world that are going to inflict themselves on the United States, and you ought to have an answer for when that problem arrives. If you stand in the way of an answer because you then can blow more air into the lungs of crisis management, well, that's just kind of irresponsible. And if you also, you know, Eric Adams, I have my arguments with Eric Adams, but he makes the point that if you let us give these people jobs, a lot of this will take care of itself very quickly. And it will. But if you also make it impossible for those people to work once they get to the place that you send them on stunt flights and with stunt buses to, then you are at every separate sequential step of the way standing in the way of a temporary solution to a temporary problem. The world is dealing with this crisis. The developed world, the rich world is dealing with this crisis. The United Kingdom is right now having a nervous breakdown over this. It's going to their Supreme Court, as the Conservative Party has said, okay, the way that we will disincentivize post-Brexit arrivals is by promising to send them to Rwanda once they get here. And right now, Britain is having a family fight about whether that is humane, legitimate, decent, even rational. Stay tuned. We don't know how that one's going to end. But what we've decided to do is decide not to decide.
Mm-hmm.
And that can't sustain as an answer. They're hoping it can last long enough to help them defeat Joe Biden. Well,
here's my last question. It's just a thought I had, and I wonder if you've ever thought of this. The reason why immigration is such an issue in America is that America, comparatively, is an extremely desirable place to be. People are desperate, and that is a word that has several connotations, but I think an accurate one, or desperate to come here. And yet, as an issue, we are riven by it. It is tearing us apart. Could it possibly be the case that America will be brought to its knees or somehow destroyed because of its desirability?
Absolutely not. I think, and have thought for a long time, that we have not had an honest conversation with ourselves about how much the country benefits. You know, we have a low fertility problem in this country the way a lot of advanced industrial countries do. But we papered over it using immigration. And that is a one-generation challenge. So, Preeti and Ramesh come in from India, and Jose and Maria come from the Dominican Republic, and they go to different places and they have different life fortunes, but their children are Americans. And they grow up in this culture and they succeed in this culture. And we get the benefit of people who are schooled in other places and trained in other places who come here to make their fortune. And yeah, maybe you end up in a muffler shop on Coney Island Avenue in Brooklyn. And that's one kind of immigrant life. But if you also have people who end up running Google, that's a different kind of immigrant story. Or Chobani. Or Olufunmi Olopade, who I profile in the book, who came here as an already trained physician from Nigeria, thinking that America would offer her more opportunity. And she and her husband are top flight doctors at the University of Chicago Medical Center. She will likely be a co-winner of a Nobel for Medicine someday in her work in breast cancer. We benefited tremendously, and we did nothing. We did nothing to earn what she brought to this country. We get it as a gift. So for every muffler repair guy, if we get an oncologist, we're doing okay.
Yeah, by the way, I might not have cancer. I'm definitely going to need a muffler at some point. So even the muffler guy has an absolute vital role to play in the economy.
Absolutely.
Politically, do you think you're a skilled rhetorician? Do you think the anecdote of the good immigrant, one you just gave, is a sufficient or would be a potent answer to the anecdote of the dangerous immigrant who you always hear about as having murdered someone or done something horrible?
I think the Republicans have been very effective in this most recent iteration of this national debate in framing immigration as criminal, as these people as criminal, as dangerous strangers who speak languages that nobody's ever heard of, and on and on, both the ridiculous and the legit. And the Democrats have been practically supine because they think they're vulnerable on this point. So they, it looks like, don't even bother to fight back. Or they think that if they just wait long enough in the rope-a-dope of this thing, the Republicans will just punch themselves out. They're not. There has to be a counter-argument. And we don't have two parties making the two counter-arguments. We have one very aggressively framing, and Donald Trump was overt about it. He said, "I call it migrant crime." And the audience went wild. Even though we know, he may know, I have no idea what he knows or doesn't know. He may know that immigrants commit crimes at lower rates than native-born citizens do. He may not know. I don't know. I don't care. But it's from his lizard brain, his very effective way of framing policies, his very effusive way of speech, that's sticking with people. Migrant crime. That sticks. Nothing doesn't stick. Nothing in response.
Right. Ray Suarez was the chief national correspondent for the PBS NewsHour, host of NPR's Talk of the Nation, and now he's the author of We Are Home, Becoming American in the 21st Century in Oral History. Ray, thank you so much.
Great to talk to you, Mike.
And that's it for today's show. Corey Wara produces The Gist. Joel Patterson is the senior producer. You know them as the Quaint Mallards. I know Michelle Pesca as the director of special projects for Peachfish Productions. The Gist is sponsored in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Thank you for listening.